By the time they caught up with the train, they'd received another surprise, as, still a half mile or so ahead of them and going like hell, it suddenly veered off the main line and onto a siding that wasn't there. As they drew nearer, Azula and Ty Lee could see that the tracks it was running on now weren't steel, but the shaped stone type that the Earth Kingdom's Earthbender trains had run on in ages past. These were appearing, rising from the desert floor as if by their own will, a short distance in front of the speeding train, then sinking away again in its wake, leaving few traces that the vehicle had ever passed that way. Earthbenders, Ty Lee remarked, her voice almost snatched away by the swoop's slipstream. What the heck is going on? I have no idea, Azula replied. We must be sure to ask them when we have a spare moment. It was at about that time that the other swoop riders realized the bike catching up to them was no longer in the hands of their colleague and circled back to deal with the problem. Two of them seemed to be firebenders, the third an earthbender, their techniques obviously adapted with some diligence and skill to the tricky business of fighting from the saddle. But none of them was half the swoop pilot Ty Lee was, nor half the bender she had for a gunner. She outmaneuvered them with fiercely grinning glee, evading the earthbender's efforts to throw up pylons and barricades in her path, confounding the firebender's attempts to catch her in a crossfire, and positioning them for Azula to pick off one by one. She went for the bikes at first, not the riders, wrecking the machinery with pinpoint bursts of flame so hot it seemed to warp the air around it. One of the firebenders was the first to go, and the look of astonishment that crossed his face as the azure flame blasted his steering vanes apart was one of the highlights of the day as far as Azula was concerned. The second braked hard to avoid plowing headlong into the cloud of dust and rocks thrown up by her colleague's crash, then slewed around it and poured on the coal to catch up. Ty Lee slalomed through another array of instant stalagmites conjured from the desert floor by the earthbender, then cut across his path so Azula could torch his swoop's power plant right out of its chassis. His dust cloud was even bigger than the others, as he frantically piled together softer soil in an attempt to break his fall. Not bad work for a man in the process of hurtling over the handlebars of his crippled bike. Azula had to give him credit for that, anyway. The second firebender was cannier, and thought she'd already seen what Azula was capable of. She stayed at longer range, darting back and forth in long arcs, far enough away that she'd have a chance to evade any bolts of fire Azula sent her way. Clever, friend, she thought, but not clever enough. Placing her hands on Ty Lee's shoulders, she rose to her feet, balancing on the narrow saddle, then closed her eyes and gathered her concentration. Bolts of the other biker's fire laced the air around her as she tried to take advantage of her more exposed position, but her own trick of staying at long range worked against her. And then, her eyes popping open, Azula showed her teeth in a cruel little grin and blew the woman clean out of the saddle with a bolt of lightning. Show off, Ty Lee called cheerfully back to her as she resumed her seat. You know you love it, Azula replied, squinting into the slipstream past her head. Don't lose them. We're in the middle of nowhere. That would be pretty hard to do, Ty Lee said, but no sooner were the words past her lips than the train had veered toward one of the red bluffs that dotted this part of the desert. As they watched, a square opening appeared in the side of the bluff, reminding them both of the way the earthbender guards of Ba Sing Se used to work the wall. The train barreled through, and the door began to close behind it. Crap, said Ty Lee, bending further over the handlebars as she pinned the throttle wide open. It was no use. They were too far away to reach the dwindling opening in time. This isn't gonna work, Ty Lee declared, sounding more disappointed than dismayed as they hurtled toward annihilation. I noticed, Azula replied dryly, Get ready to jump. Nodding, Ty Lee sprang up into a coiled crouch on the saddle, her hands still working the controls. Now! Azula cried, and without hesitation, Ty Lee backtucked, her body curling into a ball as she tumbled through the air above Azula's head. Azula timed her own exit with exquisite care, mimicking Ty Lee's starting posture. But instead of a tuck, she went straight back, her body arching, never taking her eyes off the speeding swoop as it darted away from her. An instant before she hit the ground, Azula loosed another bolt of lightning, blasting the control cluster mounted atop the swoop's micro-reactor, where it jutted up between the handlebars. The riderless machine dipped, its steering vanes biting into the earth, then cartwheeled. And just as it struck the vertical wall of the bluff, where the door had been moments before, the lobotomized fusion bottle cooked off, vaporizing the swoop in a tiny but sun-hot pulse of uncontained plasma. Rocks and dust bloomed high into the summer sky and pelted down all around Azula and Ty Lee as, for the second time in an hour or so, they rolled painfully to a halt on the desert floor.
"We have got to get a new travel agent," Azula groaned as she picked herself up once more.
"Totally," Ty Lee agreed.
"Hey, it worked," she added, pointing.
Sure enough, through the settling dust, a jagged-edged hole pierced the side of the bluff. Beyond it, from out in the sunshine, they could see only darkness.
"I thought it might," Azula replied, walking toward the hole.
"Strangely enough, that wasn't the first time I've used a fusion-powered vehicle as a high-velocity breaching charge."
She shook her head. "What is that kind of technology even doing here? Whoever these people are, they're playing with toys no one should see in Dicho for decades yet, at the very least."
"I don't know," Ty Lee said as she followed Azula into the bluff. "Somebody's definitely got some explaining to do."
By a strange coincidence, a very similar thought crossed Princess Katara's mind at around the same time, as, deep within the bluff, her stolen railway car came to a halt and a dozen black-clad, masked individuals stormed it. Apart from herself and Jing, the only people aboard that car were the conductor and two officers of the Fire Nation Security Service, a man and woman Katara thought she recognized from the seldom-seen detachment that had kept a discreet watch over her during her tenure at Piandao Academy. All three, the latter out of duty, the former out of a sense of obligation to the passengers in his care, were prepared to make a fight of it, but they were woefully outnumbered, and the attackers made short work of them. Almost before they knew what was happening, Katara and Jing were being bundled roughly off the train and marched deeper into the interior of the bluff. As they went, Katara tried to keep her wits about her, taking in as much detail as she could about their surroundings, while trying not to seem as though she were looking around too obviously. The huge chamber where the train had come to rest looked like it was built for the purpose, right down to the precisely cut trench for the tracks, placing the doors at floor level, just like the platform at a train station. For the first time, as she was being led away from it, she saw the mechanism by which the attacker's strange locomotive had taken possession of Number One sleeper car, and remarked to herself on the monstrous vehicle's heavy armor and cruel lines. This was a machine specifically conceived and constructed for this kind of mayhem, like a pirate ironclad for the land. She wondered with a faint shiver whether anyone had survived in the rest of the train. What they could see of its fate from the windows of Number One had not been encouraging.
"Aunt Azula must be alive," she told herself. "She's survived too much for something like that to be the end of her." As they progressed deeper into it, Katara saw that the whole inside of the bluff was worked in a plain but not entirely unadorned style. The passages they were hustled through were fully finished, with smooth walls, floors, and ceilings, not rough-hewn like manually cut mine shafts or randomly textured like natural caverns.
Someone, presumably with the aid of a team of skilled earthbenders, perhaps trained in mining, had put a lot of work into converting this natural landform into a sort of hidden fortress. Electrical cables, neatly secured in conduits, and pipelines of unknown purpose crisscrossed the ceilings, and the entire complex was well lit with regularly spaced glow lamps. After a few twists and turns, and one particularly long stretch of straight corridor, the two girls' captors propelled them through a massive, iron-banded double door and into a chamber that made the train platform room seem pokey by comparison. It reminded Katara a little bit of her father's throne room back home in the royal palace, a huge, echoing space, longer than wide, with a small dais at the far end as its focus. The ceiling seemed impossibly high, the walls slightly angled so as to cause the room's eyelines to converge at the focus, sheer and featureless, except for the one behind the dais, upon which hung an enormous black banner featuring a giant rendition of the blue tri-flame symbol all these people wore as a badge. And below that banner, Katara was stunned to see a massive framed painting of none other than Aunt Azula. It was an image Katara hadn't seen before, depicting Azula as she would have appeared at about 15. She had her hair up in the style so familiar to her young descendant after all their mirror meetings over the years, the style in which it was also shown in most of the historical paintings of Princess Azula that Katara had seen. But in her high, folded topknot she wore the gilded flame of the Fire Lord, the same royal emblem Katara's father had sported all her life. She wasn't smiling, but the artist had somehow contrived to give the impression that she was suppressing a smile, and not a nice one either. There was something cruel about her eyes, and something slightly unnerving, too. The pupils a little too small, the whites visible all the way around the amber-gold irises. She was only shown from the shoulders up, the same pose as all the official court portraits of the past Fire Lords that hung in the great reception hall of the royal palace. But Katara could tell that she was wearing the elaborate ceremonial armor of a fire army general, deep scarlet and black. Around her neck, on a black iron chain, providing a slightly startling contrast, she wore a round golden medallion with a square hole in the center, its face inset with polished jade. The symbol, incongruous in this context, of the Earth Kingdom. Not Princess Azula, then, but Fire Lord Azula. The self-declared 53rd Earth Queen, Azula the Conqueror, de facto ruler of half the world, captured in paint and canvas at the peak of her powers, at the peak of her madness. Katara felt a faint chill race up her spine at the thought that she was in the presence of men and women who found that version of her beloved ancestor worthy of such blatant, fawning adoration. And there were dozens of them, too, standing at attention in neat ranks on either side of a blue-carpeted central aisle, like a small army under review. Katara and Jing's captors drove them up this aisle now, toward the dais and the portrait. There was a man standing there, tall and commanding. He was dressed like all the others in blue-trimmed black, but wore a broad blue sash around his waist. Alone among the black-clad throng, he was unmasked, but even so, his grim and slightly bony face revealed little to Katara's inspection. He was middle-aged, slightly pale, with bushy black eyebrows and a drooping mustache to match. The hair on his head, thick and just beginning to gray, was drawn back into the sort of clubbed queue favored by old-fashioned Fire Navy sailors. Half his left ear was missing, only the lobe remaining beneath a shiny arc of scar tissue. An injury not uncommon, Katara knew, among Agni Kai duelists of the old, long-outlawed to-the-death school. When they reached the area just before the dais, the man propelling Katara and the others who had followed from the train all saluted this figure and then melted away into the gathered army, taking up places in their ranks. Only the one who had been coercing Jing remained, his heavy hand still gripping the back of her neck. A silent but unsubtle reminder to Katara that her friend was still quite directly in these people's power, and if the princess cared for her safety at all, she would do well to behave herself. Katara made momentary eye contact with Jing, trying to look as calm and reassuring as she could, but she could tell her friend wasn't buying it from the look she got back. The girl looked utterly terrified, her gray-green eyes enormous, sweat standing out on her brow below the slightly askew band of her cap. As she met Katara's eyes, her lower lip trembled, but then she pressed it firmly to the upper, her mouth going flat and colorless, to keep herself from crying out. Katara's heart went out to her, knowing that nothing in her best friend's life to date could possibly have prepared her for an ordeal like this. She was a merchant's daughter from Ba Sing Se, not a member of a royal family with more than its share of trouble in its history. If Katara, who did have all that background and the training to go with it, was barely keeping a handle on her composure at the moment, and she was, there was no reasonably expecting poor Jing to maintain even her legendary sang-froid. With no further time to reflect on her friend's plight, Katara turned her attention back to the unmasked man with the sash, who, to her faint surprise, made the firebender salute and bowed to her, a not entirely convincing smile coming onto his face. "Fire Princess Katara," he said, his sonorous voice reminding her incongruously of her Uncle Kazin's. "Such a pleasure to make your acquaintance at last. I am Zhu Qiang, Speaker for the Brotherhood of the Blue Flame." He made a sweeping gesture with his right hand, taking in the vast chamber and the ranks of masked men. "Welcome." Katara considered asking him why, if they were a brotherhood, at least a third of the members she'd seen so far were women, but decided that was a level of conversation she did not wish to engage in with this individual at this time. Instead, she said coldly after a moment's consideration, "Courtesy requires me to inform you that the honor is yours." Xu Qiang chuckled at that, giving her a slightly indulgent look that made her dislike him even more. "Touché, Your Highness," he said. "It's good to see that the usurper's bloodline is not entirely lacking in fire." Katara raised an eyebrow. "I beg your pardon?" she asked. "Your great-great-grandfather," Xu explained. "Plaything of Avatar Aang and his woman, betrayer of his country's principles, the architect of the Fire Nation's ignominious defeat in the war. Surely you've studied history, Your Highness." Katara's brows knitted. "Are you talking about Fire Lord Zuko?" Zhu startled her by spitting, actually spitting, on the floor of the chamber in response to her mention of her ancestor's name. She hadn't realized anyone still did that kind of thing outside of old movers. "May his shade be blighted," said Xu, and the remark, like the spitting, had a sense of ritual about it, as of something the man had been taught to do as a much younger person, and now did without really thinking about it. Then he gestured to the painting behind him. "We serve the true Fire Lord of his generation, the one whom Phoenix King Ozai named as his successor. Betrayed by her brother, murdered by your own namesake, as it happens, there's a cruel irony for you. Her legend erased from history by Aang and his henchmen. You will, I'm sure, never have been allowed even to hear her name." For just a moment, Katara found herself wondering if this man's ranting could literally be true. Not the later part. She knew very well that Aunt Azula hadn't been murdered by Master Katara the Elder or anyone else. But could he genuinely be working for her? Could everything she told Katara the Younger about her life, the mistakes she'd made, the lessons she'd learned, the happiness she'd found in the big universe, have been an elaborate fiction, covering some mad scheme to return to Dicho and seize her long-lost kingdom? "No, don't be stupid, Katara," she told herself, feeling a wash of shame that she'd even considered the possibility. She turned it into scorn, elevating her chin and giving Zhu a look of such withering disdain that it took even him slightly aback. "Her name is Azula," she said in a ringingly imperious voice. "And you will find, Zhu Qiang, that I know her far better than you do." Zhu looked genuinely startled for a moment, meeting the princess's angry gaze. Then he recovered himself and laughed lightly. "Ha ha! Well, well," he said. "It appears there's more to you than is evident at first glance." "Very well. A point to you, Princess Katara. That saves me a bit of time, actually. If you already know of her, so much the better. For soon, so far as the world is aware, you will be ruling in her name." Katara's eyebrow went up again, but she said nothing, remembering one of the lessons in parliamentarianism she'd learned from her mother. "Make silence your weapon, Katara," Chief Minister Haru told her daughter gravely. "Few can withstand it. They will feel the need to fill it if, when they expect you to comment, you decline to do so. In the process, they will often say things they had intended to keep to themselves." Katara had seen her mother put this lesson into practice many times, using a cool lack of reaction to spur adversaries on the floor of the Assembly of Ministers into unconsidered remarks. And it had the same effect now. "Under your banner, our banner," Zhu went on, gesturing to the blue tri-flame behind him, "you will restore the Fire Nation to its rightful glory, then unite it with the Earth Kingdom. Once the United Republic is crushed between them," he said, making a closing fist gesture before her to illustrate the point, "the usurper's mistakes will be undone. The world will be as it should have been these last two centuries. A proper balance will be restored." Katara's facility for the provoking silence extended only so far. At that, she couldn't stop herself from remarking, "And I suppose the Earth Kingdom will just go along with that mad scheme, will it?" "There are those in the Earth Kingdom who still remember the fall of Kuei," Zhu replied, unperturbed. "Who know, as we do, where the country's true destiny lay. You've met a few of them already, Your Highness. They made it possible for us to invite you to this gathering in the first place. When the time comes, they will not hesitate to secure your place on the Eternal Throne." "I should think the Avatar will have something to say about that," retorted Katara, more calmly than she felt. Zhu inclined his head graciously and assured her, "Have no fear on that account, Your Highness. The present holder of that office is accounted for. By the time we move on Ba Sing Se, she will no longer be in play. As for her replacement, well, he or she will be born in the Earth Kingdom." He smiled slightly, which did not appreciably help her unease, and went on, "Your subject." Katara stared at him, momentarily unable to believe what she was hearing. This man was actually, genuinely, really out loud, talking about murdering Avatar Korra to secure an open field for the rest of this organization's plan. And however unlikely a feat she considered that to be, the look of complete confidence he wore as he discussed it led her to the chilling realization that he at least thought they could pull it off. "You are completely out of your mind," she told him, waging a successful war within herself to keep her voice cold and even. "What in the world makes you think I would be party to any of that?" Then, as a non-rhetorical question occurred to her, she added, "And why do you even want me to? Since you seem to be convinced that my entire bloodline is unfit to rule," she added acidly. Zhu's bland little smile returned, sending another ripple of unease through her, and he replied calmly, "Oh, you won't be ruling. Not really. but the appearance that you are will be of invaluable service in restraining certain elements of the fire army and the public, and once they're dealt with, you'll be a useful distraction for the opponents of progress to fixate upon. As for what will ensure that you play your part, well, does your unexpected knowledge of history extend to an organization known as the Dai Li? If so, you may be familiar with certain techniques they customarily employed to maintain order. Katara did, in fact, know what he was talking about. Azula had mentioned the Dai Li several times in recent years. When she had at last deemed the younger princess ready to know the strangest and most sordid details of that dark period of her life. The growing sense of apprehension she'd felt throughout this bizarre interview blossomed into a genuine pall of dread, as she realized that, with those black arts in his hands, this lunatic might just be able to make at least some of his mad plan come to pass after all. Before she could find the words to make any reply, though, there came a curious tearing noise and a grinding crunch from behind her, a bit off to the right. Turning, she saw the guard who had been holding Jing hostage pitch backward and sprawl flat on his back to the floor, as if he had taken an uppercut to the chin. In front of him, Jing stood in a peculiar stance, fists clenched, shoulders slightly hunched. One of her legs was slightly extended before her, the heel of her right shoe resting in a small depression in the floor. Behind her back, a narrow column of stone about the diameter of a clenched fist jutted up through a hole in the carpet, standing a good 6 feet high. The flat top of the column was smeared with blood and studded with a couple of small objects it took Katara a moment to recognize as teeth. Slowly, as if putting on a demonstration, Jing lifted her foot out of the divot her heel had made, and the column of stone fell back into the floor behind her. Then she brushed the sleeves of her Earth Kingdom tunic up her arms, and struck a wide, flat-footed, four-square stance that was instantly recognizable to anyone with Katara's training. For a second, nobody moved, as Zhu Qiang, Katara, and every last masked person in the chamber all stared at her in shared astonishment. "I think I've heard enough," said Jing, all traces of her earlier terror having vanished from her face. Then, tilting her head slightly at her roommate, she added offhandedly, "Close your mouth, Katara. It's unladylike to gawp." Katara blinked at her, blinked again, and then darted to her side. Within a second, the two girls were back to back, both in ready stances, as the brothers, as Katara supposed they must be called, men or women, of the blue flame shook off their shock and broke ranks, surrounding them. "You never told me you were a bender," Katara muttered over her shoulder. "You never asked," Jing replied, unconcerned. "Oh, please, I must have asked at some point," Katara grumbled. "Nope, I'm pretty sure you didn't," said Jing. "Brothers, have a care," said Zhu, his manner still as calm as if he were serving dinner. "You may kill the earthbender if you like, but kindly remember that Princess Katara needs to be no worse off than someone who has survived a train wreck." Surveying the force arrayed against them, at least 100 strong, Katara and Jing concluded, without having to discuss it, that they were almost certainly going to lose this fight, but also that they were going to give the best accounting for themselves that they could manage in the process. Then the brothers charged, and battle was joined. It was one for the book, for the two defenders might be a pair of teenage girls, but it quickly became apparent that they were among the finest benders of the age. In Katara's case, this was perhaps not that surprising. As Fire Princess, she had had the finest teachers and the most diligent training since she was old enough to stand, starting with her own mother and father, and extending to many of the greatest masters of the art. The roll call of those who had taught Katara the Younger to master the flame had included Avatar Korra herself, a firebending prodigy in her own right, despite her Water Tribe lineage, and, of course, her Aunt Azula,
possibly the most powerful non-avatar firebender who ever lived. Jing's prowess was more of a surprise, particularly given that until 20 seconds ago, even Katara, her roommate all through Piandao Academy and inarguably her best friend in the world, hadn't even known she was a bender. For the past 7 years, she must have received her training only during school holidays and practiced only in rare, brief, private moments. Yet she was powerful, precise, and confident. And, it became apparent as the battle raged on, utterly, utterly ruthless. Even in these dire straits, Katara was trying to temper her flame, defending herself to the utmost, but unwilling to employ her full power for fear of killing her opponents. Jing had no such compunctions. She held nothing back, unleashing enough havoc to destroy a small town if one had been available. She wasn't trying to kill the brothers, but she wasn't trying not to either. It simply didn't appear to matter to her whether they lived or died, in exactly equal measure to Zhu's indifference to her own survival. Within the space of a few minutes that felt like hours, the room was in shambles, its stone walls and floor pockmarked where the combatants had torn pieces of them away and scarred by the blackened traces of stray fire. Broken men and women in black leather lay scattered like victims of a plane crash, some dead, many merely wishing they were. The former occupants of Room 82A had accounted very well for themselves indeed. But in the end, their strength was exhausted before the enemy's manpower. First one, then the other, fell before a concerted counterattack led by Zhu himself. Katara was unconscious for only a moment after the final blow slammed her against the wall. The 30 or so brothers who remained on their feet were still a dozen yards or more away when she stirred and tried to rise. Jing lay next to her, sprawled on her back, her face a mask of blood from a cut on her forehead, and for a horrible moment Katara thought she was dead. After a moment she roused, groaning, and opened one eye, focusing it uncertainly on her best friend's face.
"How we doing?"
she asked weakly. "Not great," Katara replied honestly.
"Well..."
Jing tried to sit up, but nothing seemed to be working anymore. With a cough, she gave up and sank back down, tilting her head back to get an upside-down look at the approaching foe.
"We gave it our best shot," she concluded philosophically. "See you in the spirit world, princess."
"Just stay down," said Katara grimly, pushing herself to hands and knees, then rising into a crouch. "I'm not done yet. I have to take back some of what I said about your bloodline, Your Highness," said Zhu cordially as he strode through the ranks of his surviving minions to stand before her. "Your spirit, at least, is worthy of admiration. But the gesture is made, and your strength is at an end, I think. Are you going to go on insisting on making my day difficult now?" "I'm going to do worse than that," Katara snarled, willing herself into as upright a position as her bruised and scorched body would adopt. "I'm going to ruin all your schemes." "I hardly see how you expect to manage that," Zhu admitted, looking mockingly intrigued. Katara smiled coldly at him, baring bloody teeth, looked him straight in the eye, and told him flatly, "I'm going to give you no choice but to kill me." An instant before she could hurl herself into a patently suicidal renewed attack, though, another thing occurred that changed the whole tenor of the occasion. Some distance away, to her right, the double doors suddenly burst open, flying from their hinges in a great ball of flame, as if a tank had fired at them from the other side. They slammed to the floor, iron bands glowing cherry red and wooden panels ablaze, and skidded a few yards into the room before fetching up against some of the rubble left behind by the battle. Beyond them, the great corridor leading back to the rest of the compound was a scene of carnage to rival even the assembly hall itself, strewn with wreckage and the motionless forms of dozens more brothers. Everything that could be on fire out there was. Backlit by the flames, two slim figures strode into the room. One, Katara saw, was Aunt Azula's companion Ty Lee, dressed in some sort of high-tech-looking commando gear. Her face, to Katara's momentary surprise, until she remembered some of the old stories, painted in the distinctive mask of a Kyoshi warrior. The other, discarding the limp form of still another brother as she entered, was Azula herself, proud and elegant despite the torn and battered state of her person, her red-striped trousers out at the knee, boots scuffed and marked, scarlet silk shirt ragged at the cuffs and missing half its buttons, her long black hair in wildly tousled disarray. She still held the badge from her last opponent's uniform in her right hand as she entered the great hall. Seeing her niece all but beaten but unbowed, and the remains of her and her roommate's handiwork scattered all around the room, she smiled. "Katara, dear, I don't wish to seem as though I'm criticizing your kindly and open new future society, but in my day we traveled in warships and this kind of thing didn't happen," she remarked offhandedly. "I'm just saying." "So noted," Katara replied, doing her best to keep the delighted relief surging in her heart from breaking her game face. Azula turned her attention to the unmasked man who was plainly the leader of the force confronting her niece, sauntering insouciantly toward him and regarding the badge she held with a look of thoughtful disdain. "Brotherhood of the Blue Flame, eh?" she remarked. Then, stopping 20 paces or so from Zhu Qiang, she tossed the badge casually at his feet, tore a strip of silk from one of her ragged sleeves, and started arranging her hair. "Well," she went on as she worked at that, "if you ladies and gentlemen sincerely think Princess Azula would be impressed with your actions today..." With quick, long-practiced motions, she fixed most of her hair into an elaborately folded topknot in the old-fashioned style, then took what was left free in the front and divided it with her fingers, smoothing its halves into a single lock on either side that perfectly framed her face. Fully transformed, she smiled coolly at Zhu. "I'm afraid I have some bad news for you." As his masked subordinates backed away in shock, clearing a path between them, Zhu stared at her in shocked recognition. It took him a few moments to find his voice. When he did, it was to cry, "How can this be?" "Do you know, you're not the first person to ask me that," said Azula, still advancing. "But..." Zhu involuntarily backed up a step, then two. "Your Majesty, if you'll listen to my plan," he said, doing his best to recover his smooth confidence. "I have listened to your plan, Admiral Zhu," Azula snapped, then muttered under her breath. "Acne, what is it with you Navy people?" Not waiting for him to make any reply to that, she told him, "Your colleagues outside were falling over themselves to tell me all about it. Let me see if I've grasped the basic outline." Her tone curiously light and conversational, she went on, "You intended to use ancient Dai Li brainwashing techniques to make my niece here the figurehead of a mad plot to plunge the world into a new dark age of terror and misery, one that would make the 100-year war look like amateur night at my old lunatic asylum." Zhu opened his mouth to lodge some objection, but before he could get it out, Azula cut him off, her voice suddenly a whip crack. "In my name!" Then, with a cordially inquisitive head tilt, she added, "Is that about the size of it? If so, I confess I'm finding it hard to articulate on precisely how many levels that is simply unacceptable." Zhu kept staring at her,
his jaw working silently for a few moments. Then he seemed to come to some internal decision. The consternation cleared from his face, leaving it as stony and impassive as it had been when Katara first saw it. He ceased to back away, straightening up, and then assumed a firebending ready stance.
"What a terrible disappointment you are, Your Majesty," he said gravely. Shaking his head in resignation, he added, "You should have stayed dead."
Azula's mouth quirked into a sardonic half-smile. "Look after things here, will you, darling?" she said to Ty Lee, without taking her eyes off Zhu. "The Admiral and I need to have a frank exchange of views." All other factors being equal, Azula entered this battle at a significant disadvantage. It was, for her, the end of a very long day, starting with a train wreck and escalating from there. She had long since ceased to keep count of the number of people she'd had to fight her way through, with Ty Lee's very considerable help, but still, just to get to this room. Granted, few of them had been what she would consider really able combatants, but quantity posed its own problems. For his part, Zhu was the most formidable opponent she'd had in quite some time. Having taken minimal part in the battle just fought here, he was fresh and rested, and now that he'd gotten over his shock at her appearance and her rejection of his plans, he was focused, relentless, implacable. He was obviously not just a highly trained and experienced firebender, but specifically a duelist, a man who had optimized his skills for the task of facing and defeating other firebenders in single combat. In that very specialized field of combat, he probably had a great deal more experience than she did. If one didn't count her collaboration with Zuko to destroy the damned and risen shade of their father on the day of the Ragnarok, this was Azula's first proper Agni Kai since that long-ago, comet-fueled clash with her brother in the capital. She recalled little of that occasion. It had gone by in a sort of liminal blur, intense but out of focus, the sensations smeared into a jumble of colors and sounds by the inward spiral of her madness. Since the end of the world, she and Zuko and Katara, the Elder, had all talked about it, ultimately reaching a level of understanding she would never have considered possible. But she still couldn't be said to remember the experience, which, they had all agreed, was probably just as well. In the end, though, none of Zhu's presumed advantages mattered much. Azula may well have been the less experienced, straight-up Agni Kai duelist, and she was certainly battered and tired. At moments like this, despite her Phoenix module, despite the golden apples of Asgard, despite everything, she felt every day of her nearly 205 years. But, because that was the way she was wired, every single one of them only made her stronger. Katara sat on the floor next to Jing, whom Ty Lee had helped into a sitting position against the wall, and watched her aunt do battle with the renegade admiral. She had never seen an old-fashioned Agni Kai before, only the modern sporting version, and the difference struck her at once. The sporting form was powerful and aggressive, but also decorous, almost courteous, in its formality and punctility. This kind of combat, while still obviously underpinned by ritual and tradition, had a savage edge to it that she had never seen before today. It was like her own battles against a dozen or more of the men and women who now lay scattered around the room, but more concentrated, because the two combatants were giving each other their undivided attention and holding nothing back. And for all his power, all his technique, and all his fury, Zhu Qiang never once laid a flame on Azula. Despite being the leader of a body of people calling themselves the Brotherhood of the Blue Flame, Zhu did not possess that rare and special skill. To the best of Katara's knowledge, no one had since Azula herself, Katara included. It required an understanding of, a connection to, the fire within that was beyond even the most powerful firebenders of the modern age.
Ju's flame was the regular orange-red, and Azula could turn it aside with gestures that sometimes looked too casual even to have been deliberate actions. Her footwork had the elegance of a dance, so much so that it made Ju's own expert maneuvering seem like so much flat-footed lummocking around. Within 2 minutes, Ju's uniform was ragged, his flesh beneath blistered and scorched in a dozen places. In an ordinary Agni Kai, even one declared in deadly serious anger, the proceedings would have been ended with the first of those burns. But not here, not today. Dismay began rising in him as he deployed every single one of his skills at the fullest limit of his killing intent and came up empty every single time. At which point he revealed the true core of his character by shouting for his minions to come to his aid. Outrage boiled up within Katara as most of the remaining Blue Flame brothers ran to comply with their master's instruction, almost wiping away her own fatigue and pain for the moment. Her fists clenching, she made to rise and wade back into the fray herself, only to be stopped by Ty Lee's hand on her shoulder. She rounded on the elder but smaller woman, fury flashing in her eyes. But Ty Lee only smiled, the expression curiously contrasting with the fierce mask of her Kyoshi warrior makeup. "Relax," she said. "Stay with Jing. I got this." And so saying, she launched herself at the back of the charging group without a backward glance. Katara and Jing looked at each other. Jing looked much better, with the blood wiped away from her face and a field dressing applied to the cut on her forehead, and her color was returning after an injection of something Ty Lee had given her while propping her against the wall. And then back at the battle. They could no longer see what was going on with Azula and Ju. Their attention was entirely occupied by the astonishing sight of one small, green-clad woman, unarmed and a non-bender, completely owning a group of 30 fire and earthbenders, mostly heavily built and all in a homicidal frame of mind. She moved so fast and so nimbly that at times it seemed like there were two or three of her, and wherever she went, men and women fell. In what seemed like less than a minute, her work was finished, and as the last of them went down, Katara saw that Azula's was too. Ju lay sprawled on the floor, trying to scramble backward and not making a lot of progress. His impassive mask had been replaced by a look of utter, abject terror. The man was actually keening, a high, inarticulate sound of terror spilling from his mouth as he raised his scorched and bloodied hands in a futile effort to shield his face. Above him, just reaching the peak of a great, bounding, fire-fueled leap, Azula seemed to hang for an instant in midair, her right hand drawn back like a claw, wreathed in azure flame. And then she fell, and Ju's keening became a full-on scream, the terrified cry of a man who knows he has just entered the last second of his life. Azula let him scream for 4 seconds, until he suddenly realized that he had not, in fact, died in agony, and, the cry dying away into a querulous noise, opened his eyes. Her fist stood a half inch or so above his face, so near he could feel the heat of the flame, yet it did not burn him. Utterly confused, he focused past it on her face. It wore a look of utter contempt, as of a woman regarding someone she doesn't even consider worth despising. "You lose, Admiral," she told him. "What?" Ju blinked at her, then gathered his dignity as best he could, which wasn't very, and demanded, "What are you playing at? Finish it!" Azula's eyes hardened then, becoming ever so faintly like the cruel, wild eyes of the painting by the dais. Then, to his shock, she withdrew her hand, dismissing the flame with a little flick of her fingers, and smiled, straightening up. "No," she said. Ju gave her a look of complete incomprehension. "Why not?" because that's what you want me to do, Azula replied casually. At which, just to complete her dismissal of him, she turned her back and walked toward Katara and the others. His expression still mystified, Zhu dragged himself into a sitting position. Surrounded by the ruins of his headquarters, of his organization, and of his master plan, he just sat. Unbound, not even really seriously wounded, he was nevertheless so completely beaten that he could do nothing but contemplate his defeat. Ty Lee's first instinct was to go and secure him anyway. Too many years as bodyguard to the most nearly assassinated man in the world had left her constitutionally unable to leave a potential threat just lying around. Before she had the chance, a circular section of the hugely high ceiling suddenly wasn't there anymore, admitting a shaft of brilliant sunlight that lanced down through the dust and smoke of combat to paint a circle of white on the floor in the center of the room. The few people still conscious looked up in surprise to see a single figure, silhouetted against the bright blue desert sky, drop into the hole. This figure free fell, perhaps halfway to the floor, then suddenly whirled into a kind of miniature tornado that touched gently down in the middle of the disk of light. With a blast of hot wind and a scattering of smaller debris, the whirlwind dispersed, leaving the familiar shape of Avatar Korra standing in the center of the room. Her face was fixed in a scowl of concentration as she emerged, her ponytail and sidelocks whipping in the dissipating wind. Clearly she was expecting, perhaps even welcoming, the trouble she assumed she had just dropped into the midst of. When it registered on her that there wasn't any here, she blinked, looking momentarily confounded. Even after the day she'd just had, Katara couldn't help but giggle at the sight. Okay, said the Avatar after a moment's consternation. I guess everything's under control here. The person nearest to her, a slim, dark-haired woman in the tattered remains of a red shirt and black trousers, turned and walked toward her with a weary, sardonic smile. You Avatars always have such impeccable timing, she remarked. Korra took a quarter step back and blinked at her, blue eyes going wide with two layers of astonished recognition. Azula, she declared, and just for an instant, unlike when she had been speaking to Katara's graduating class, she really did sound just like Aang, not in the timbre of her voice, but her manner of speaking. What are you doing here? Then, before Azula could answer, she blinked again, shaking her head, and added in a voice much more her own, I looked all over for you. Where have you been? Azula's smile became a bit less sardonic. Oh, you know, here and there, she said airily. Sorry if you were expecting some action when you got here, but we thought you might find it refreshing if someone didn't just wait around for you to save the day for once. Anyway, I'm afraid I simply can't have you broadcasting my return to the public at large, so I shall have to have my associate Ty Lee erase your memory with a secret technique she learned in Ryo's Unpaku. Be a dear and stand still. I'm assured it's mostly painless. While Azula was speaking, Ty Lee had been gliding into position for one of her patented ambush hugs, but just before she could spring, Korra suddenly wasn't there anymore, whirling and slipping out of her reach in an airbender evasion that, again, put Azula powerfully in mind of Aang. Thwarted, Ty Lee abandoned the attempt, pouting slightly. That was a joke, Korra, calm down, said Azula, rolling her eyes slightly. Waterbenders, so literal-minded. They got into Ba Sing Se Central Station an hour after dark, 6 hours late and without any of the Western Empire Express, though the rest of the passengers, none of whom, to Katara's mild astonishment, had been killed in the wreck, would be arriving by relief train an hour or two behind them. For Princess Katara and her friends, the ride into the city was the full VIP treatment, personally conducted by and under the protection of the Avatar herself, and her faithful polar bear dog, of course. When they left the Hollow Bluff, it was already swarming with Earth Kingdom Royal Investigative Service officers and FNSS personnel, shocked into an uncharacteristic collaboration by the international nature of the conspiracy, but Katara couldn't say she cared about that right now. All she cared about, as their Avatar-propelled land raft glided into the station, was that she and Jing were alive and likely to stay that way. The RIS and FNSS were jointly in evidence here as well, having sealed off the station platform at which they were arriving to keep the press and public at bay. The only other people waiting there were Katara's parents and a pair of people the Fire Princess recognized as the 55th Earth King and his wife, Queen Consort Jian. She knew them in passing, having been introduced at several state functions over the years, but she had hardly expected to see them now. "Oh, man," she murmured to Jing. "I guess we're in for the full royal treatment. I'm sorry, we'll just have to put up with it. Hopefully they'll let us go before too long so we can find your parents and tell them you're all right." Jing smiled and straightened her somewhat damaged hat. "It's okay," she assured her friend. She was still limping, and every now and again she would move in a way that particularly hurt and flinch slightly, breath hissing between her teeth. All the same, the first aid she'd received from Tai Li, plus a helping of waterbender healing administered by the Avatar, had set Jing back on her feet very well. Between them, they'd short-circuited what Katara had been reasonably sure would be a month or more in hospital after the terrible pounding she'd taken in their battle against the Brotherhood. The four of them were all bruised, scraped, and battered, their clothes, apart from Tai Li's tactical gear, ragged and filthy, but they were standing straight and in good spirits as they disembarked from Korra's rail raft to stand before the four royal personages. Before anyone could say anything, the Earth King, a tall, solemn-faced, somewhat avuncular man, whom Katara rather liked for his dignity and occasional flashes of wry humor, stepped forward and addressed Jing directly. "Jing Jie, welcome home. You are well?" Jing interlocked her fingers before her chest in the earthbender salute and, stiffly and with a bit of a wince, bowed. "Ni hao, father. Well enough." Then she straightened up and grinned, abandoning the formal pretense, and added, "And you should see the other guys." The Earth King laughed and embraced his daughter, remarking cheerfully, "That's my girl." Katara, and some part of her was gratified to see, her parents, stared at the scene in astonishment while Queen Jian laughed decorously behind her fan. "Get out!" Katara burst out. "You mean to tell me all this time? Why, you told me your parents were merchants." Jing half turned, still in her father's arms, and smiled. "No, I said they lived in a big house in the upper city and were quite well off. You assumed they must be merchants." Katara put her fists on her hips. "I cannot believe this," she said indignantly. "Please don't be angry with Jing Jie, Your Highness," said Queen Xian gently. "She meant no disrespect. Quite the opposite. She has treasured your friendship all the more because you gave it without knowing she was of a similar station."
"It's an old tradition in our family," said the Earth King with a sage nod, "to walk the world as an ordinary person, sometimes for many years, before taking up our royal duties. It began with my great-grandfather, Kuei, the 52nd Earth King."
"I don't think this is really the time for a history lesson, Dad," Jing put in. Disengaging, she turned to Katara and said, "Mom's right, though. I might be a princess, too, but it's really meant a lot to me that I didn't have to be. Come on, After the day we've had... She extended a hand. Don't be like this.
Katara folded her arms and glared.
You are a spider rat, she declared.
Jing grinned.
But you love me.
Katara sustained her glare for a second or two longer, then caved in and hugged her best friend.
Not in that way, they said in unison.
Off to one side and a little behind, Azula and Ty Lee glanced at each other and shared a private little smile. The smile of people who understood, in that way or not, how precious such a bond could be. A moment later, while the two princesses' mothers had their turns welcoming them back to civilization, and the Earth King conferred briefly with Korra, Azula was a little surprised to be taken aside by Fire Lord Kinzon with a murmured,
Captain Inazuma, a moment, if I may.
Azula wasn't expecting to be recognized here. Even without having taken her hair back down, she was confident in her real identity being so completely out of context that no one would think of it. It was, after all, 200 years after her time. Apart from Korra, she expected that even if anyone did recognize her, it would be to think, hey, that girl looks like, what's her name, the crazy princess from the war. Not, hey, there's Princess Azula. She certainly hoped that would be the case. It wouldn't have surprised her to learn that she was still wanted for war crimes in Ba Sing Se, in the same sort of sense that weird laws about people having to walk in front of horseless carriages with flags and the like were occasionally left on the books. As such, she was taken mildly aback when the Fire Lord scrutinized her carefully, then shook his head and said in a quiet voice,
I don't know. I'm not sure I believe you really are who you seem to be, but Katara believes it.
With a wry little smile, he chuckled and added,
Regardless, you are real, which is rather more than I was expecting out of my daughter's imaginary friend.
Azula smiled, then regarded him more closely, the expression slipping to a concerned demi-frown. Kinzon was only in his early 70s, not so old nowadays, particularly by the standards of the traditionally long-lived Fire Nation royal family, but he looked drawn, weary. She supposed the crisis his daughter had just been through would have something to do with that, but still, at this close range, to her perceptive eye, the Fire Lord did not seem an entirely well man.
Are you all right? She wondered, her voice low. Is there anything I can do?
Kinzon shook his head again, his wry smile flashing.
There's nothing anyone can do for me, he said matter-of-factly. Besides, you've already done the most important thing I could ever ask of anyone. You've saved my heir.
He paused, then went on.
And our country is going to need her soon. She isn't ready, he added in that same matter-of-fact tone. But she's strong. She'll prevail. I hope I can count on you to be there for her again in her next hour of need.
Azula regarded him for a long, thoughtful moment. Then, squaring herself to him, she made the firebender salute and bowed.
Fire Lord, she said, it would be my honor.
Thank you,
said Kinzon gravely, returning the gesture. They said nothing more about it, rejoining the group without comment. Shortly thereafter, Kinzon and Haru bade their daughter a relieved and affectionate goodbye and left to return to their own capital, secure in the knowledge that Katara was in good hands in Ba Sing Se. The rest of them repaired to the Earth King's palace to partake of an enormous dinner, hot baths, and the finest available guest quarters.
So what do you think?
Ty Lee asked after they'd shut out the lights and sunk gratefully into the colossal bed of their literally palatial guest room.
About? Azula wondered, already beginning to slide into what she was entirely certain was going to be truly enjoyable unconsciousness.
Dicho, Ty Lee said, snuggling up to her back with an arm around her middle. Has coming home been everything you thought it would be?
Azula chuckled sleepily.
Well, she allowed, I'm glad the old place hasn't gotten dull. And so saying, Fire Princess Azula slept the sleep of the just.
Avery Productions Unlimited presented Undocumented Features, Desolation Angel, Travels with the Phoenix Queen, An Exile, Twilight, Future Imperfect, Dicho Adventure, written and read by Benjamin D. Hutchins with Philip Jeremy Moyer. Azula will return.